Fishing Frank here again. Robert in the chair across from me, and RJ up in commanding control in his golden gilded chrome tower of power.
Don't forget to mention the diamonds.
The diamonds. I always forget about your bling, man.
Yeah.
You know, there's so much going on in that tower. But our special guest today is right here next to me. And my name's Sheephead. I'd go along with my buddies, Jimmy Bag of Donuts, and I spent a little time, you know, I hang out under the docks, the piers, the kind of the bad area, the neighborhood. I've been doing this for a while, and I'm not as healthy as I used to be, but we go out, you know, I'm underneath the docks, I'm underneath the piers. This is the time of year I want to get together with the ladies, you know. Most of the year, you know, you can kind of come and go with it. It's okay to watch a stage show or whatever you do. But for me now, things are going to get serious. I'm going to get together. I'm going to start a whole new gang. My specialty is I'm a thief. I'm a bait thief. I spend a little time for it, but it's what I do. I steal bait. I go under the pier, you drop your line down. The bait is mine. There's nothing you can do about it. Maybe you try setting a hook before you leave the house. But I'm telling you, you're going to put that bait down, I'm going to get it. Whether it's a fiddler crab, whether it's a sand flea, a piece of shrimp, it's mine for the taking, and I'm going to laugh my way all the way to a full belly. This is what I do. Robert, what do you think? Is this something real that they could, you know, he could actually get away with this in today's society?
Oh, jeez.
Where do we go with this?
Yeah, right?
First, get him to put that fish back in the tank.
Wow.
That was what? What?
That was just like way left of center, but.
It hurt, too.
Actually.
I noticed, yeah.
Yeah, actually.
You sustained that pretty well for as rough as that is on the throat. So, but no, they definitely, sheep's head are very, very abundant out there right now. That's like what everyone's excited about it. And yes, they are very much the bait thieves that everyone makes them out to be. You know, these sheep's head are different than the northerner's sheep head. And a lot of people get confused by that. You know, this fish is actually in the porgy family, and it's an extremely good-eating fish. Highly desirable, can be caught from a boat or from shore, which makes it even better. And, yeah, it doesn't matter if you're using a crab, a shrimp, a sand flea. They're tough. They will challenge some of the best anglers around. You know, and it doesn't seem to matter what you use for a hook or how your rig is. It's definitely a fish that will challenge you in the beginning for quite a little while. And that's kind of one of the things that I think's fascinating about them personally.
Well, what I like is it's a pretty basic little fish. You find some structure. Now, most people don't understand sheephead live in the Gulf of Mexico as adults. That's their primary place of residence. And they live on the same reefs as you would find snappers, grunts, porgies, grouper, things like that. But they actually go a lot deeper than people would suspect. It's not just a very near shore thing. The reason we don't see a lot of them during the year, it's kind of like crappie fishing. In freshwater here, we have crappie season, which starts as soon as you get those cold winds blowing across the water, and sheephead season starts at the same thing. So we have two completely different, completely opposite species. One's in freshwater, one's in saltwater, but they both have the same habit. Now, The reason we don't see a lot of them is they're scattered everywhere.
Right.
They don't hang out in big groups. Outside of spawning season, 2-3 together would be, 3 would probably be tops. There'd probably be one here, another one over there, another one over there. Kind of lone sheephead things. They don't bunch up.
Yeah, they're not a social type fish.
And it's really funny because I remember when those underwater cameras were first coming out.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that? And yeah. We were taking them to bridges, dropping down next to the pilings and looking around and everything. And there'd be like a half old tricycle with a sheephead on it.
Yeah. Just one.
Yeah, just one sheephead hanging out under this half a piece of tricycle. At least that's what I think it looked like. But as we went around through different areas in the canals and out in the harbor, and that one happened to be off one of the bridges in Port Charlotte Canal. But you would see a sheephead here or a sheephead there. But now they're going to get together in schools of literally thousands sometimes.
Yeah.
But the first thing that happens, they leave that very deep water from out in the Gulf, and they come up to the very near shore reefs, the ones that are within, I would say, 6 miles of the coast.
Yeah.
And they're going to come up as close as possible. Not all of the larger ones will come up in the harbor. Because some of those sheephead are 20, 24 inches, bigger. I mean, there's some really huge monster ones. But it's unlikely they come up into the harbor to spawn. They're going to do most litters on the near shore reefs.
Yeah, they don't really have to. You know, they just stay out there and get together in their own size range. Because that seems to happen a lot when you get some of these fish, when they get into some of their spawns, is that they seem to kind of gather in similar sizes.
Not 12-inch go not as drastic. 12 to 14-inch, 18 to 20 inches, yeah. 20 inches up, that kind of thing.
Exactly. You know, it's not as narrow as, say, a trout is or a redfish is, but they definitely are going to be segregated in their own little size groups of spawning aggregates. So those big boys, they stay out there. Plus, the bigger they are, the less they are preyed upon. So they're not as scared of some of the other fish out there, and that's why your smaller ones will start to move in closer and even inshore.
The weird thing about it for me is really the only place, there's two places that I know of, and there's probably a couple more, and you might, if your area, the coastline, has this kind of feature to it, it's likely you have some there and we just don't know about it. What you're looking for is a pass with consistently more than 6 feet of water in it. And then a deep water channel next to that, and then preferably some docks up there. Now, what I'm describing is when you come in Stump Pass and then make a left up Ski Alley, and at the top of that, there's a bunch of docks there. Now, some of the biggest sheephead consistently come from that area within the next couple of months. They could be there now. They might not be there for another month or even until early January. But at some point, a bunch of bigger sheephead come in there and spawn. Now, I would think the same thing might be true of somewhere like Captiva Pass, where you have the pass, and then just inside you have a bunch of big docks. I think it might be the Goliath grouper that keep the sheephead from doing much of that inside of Boca Grande Pass. Because the only place they have right inside is the old phosphate dock.
Right.
And there's so many fish there that would eat a 20-inch sheephead. You know, there's 400, 600-pound Goliath grouper hanging out underneath there. You know, average is probably 100 pounds, 80 to 100, but there's still some bigger ones. And an 80-pound Goliath grouper is going to eat a big fish.
Oh, absolutely.
So I think that's why we don't see as many right inside of Boca Grande Pass is because of the amount of huge predators right there.
Yeah. No, and I'd agree with that. But they do still get quite a few sheep's head there on the phosphate dock, but just not to the volume you would expect to see, like you're saying.
And not to the size I would expect.
No. Just a lot of people go there because it's convenient, it's easy, and it's very, very impressive with all of it.
Was that your stomach?
It was.
Really? I thought the pipes were leaking here in this thing.
Oh.
Wow.
Yeah. The
you're going to be running away soon. Okay. Think about it, Robert. I'll ponder on that. Oh, I gotta go.
Yeah.
So anyway, Book.
Come on, we're all human. Get over it. You know? Part of it. I'm sitting there coughing and doing all kinds of other crazy stuff myself.
Another bit of trivia with those fish is they're very aggressive with each other, and that's why you see them in similar size ranges when they get together, and that's why you don't see large amounts of them around structure, because they drive each other off.
Until it comes to spawning time.
Until it comes to spawning time, then all bets are off. Then we're all good friends at that point.
Yeah. Well, you know, 2 o'clock at the bar, it's closing time.
But
you know.
I think even with the spawning schools, though, you see them in pretty similar sizes because the big guys chase the smaller guys off.
All right.
Yeah. Oh, and I can see that. I mean.
Yeah, if you keep saltwater aquaria, like the big stuff like they do at the aquarium up in Tampa and places like that, they don't get along with each other. So.
Right, well, no, good point of fact, yeah, that and that explains why they're spread out, and then, okay, you get an overwhelming urge, so.
Yeah.
But out of all the stuff out there, the best baits for sheephead is fiddler crabs, sand fleas, and peeled shrimp meat.
Yes, definitely.
I would say you can use live shrimp. You can use small bait fish, you know, like silver sides. You can use a lot of different stuff. But if I was going to rank them up, now, sand fleas are harder and harder to find because of beach renourishment. When they go in and they pump or dump all this sand on the beaches, it wipes out most of the sand flea population.
Yeah.
There is very little left alive after that happens, and it takes years to build it back up again. And usually just about the time we start getting a good population of sand fleas, they do it again. So, fiddler crabs, we sell at Fish and Frank's farm-raised fiddler crabs. And it took me a long time to find them because I was really tired of buying fiddler crabs caught in the wild. Because you know they're depleting that resource out there, the natural resource.
Right.
So we were able to find a company who provides us with farm-raised fiddler crabs. And that is awesome. We're not depleting the environment of them. You know, the wild fiddler crabs can still grow and develop. And we get them, you know, off a farm. It's the same reason we don't buy wild shiners. I don't sell wild shiners, even though there's a lot of money in it. But wild freshwater shiners, to me, is a rape and pillage operation. And they go around and literally wipe out entire areas, and they just keep circling the state, taking all of the best bait out to sell. And, you know, I like money. I mean, it buys me guitars and this and that and the next thing. But it's not, it can't be the driving force of your life. If it is, you need a new life.
Right.
So having enough money to have a good time with is one thing. Just doing anything you can to make another dollar is not a good thing. So we don't sell wild-caught freshwater shiners, and now we don't have to. And we didn't carry fiddler crabs for, what, 2-3 years?
Yeah, probably.
And it was because I didn't want to get them where I had to get them from.
Well, people don't realize it's like they think sheep's head just show up here. And there's a lot of fish that are, like, seasonal to certain areas. But when sheep's head show up here, they actually show up in the whole state at almost the same time.
Yep.
From the Panhandle down to the Keys to Jacksonville. They inundate the coastlines and become in their big spawning aggregates, so everyone wants to target them. And when you've got all these people going out and collecting wild-caught fiddler crabs to sustain the entire state wanting them at the same time, it's an astonishing amount.
Millions and millions of fiddler crabs get sold each year.
Each week, now, I would probably guess statewide.
I'm not that great of a person. If you know me, you know that's absolutely true. But there are certain things that I want to do because I want my kids, my grandkids, which I have 7 of, by the way, to be able to do what I did. And I would like them to be able to go out and find wild fiddlers, but they're very rare.
Yeah,
I knew of 3 colonies, and the last time I was there, 1 still existed. And that was 2 years ago. So I don't know what's happened since. But the good news is, if each of us did something little, you don't have to do big things to help. But fixating on straws, get a life. The dumbest thing I've ever heard of. You know, this little straw is going to end the world, but that big styrofoam cup, oh, that, don't worry about it. I'm just a weirdo. But with the sheep head, they get their name because they have the same looking teeth as a sheep, which look a lot like human teeth. Now, the other prevalent fish that you're going to find underneath these piers and stuff are the black drum. Now, small, less than 20-inch black drum in that 10, 12, 14-inch range are heavily striped just like a sheep head. In fact, the Marine Patrol calls them bearded sheep head, and they love them because the sheep head has a 14-inch size limit, a much larger size limit than the sheep head does. So if you get a, I'm sorry, I said that wrong. The black drum black have drum. A 14-inch size limit, but looks 85% just like a sheep head. And the best way to tell is a black drum has a beard, and sheep head have no beard and a teeth. So sheep head have teeth, black drum have a beard. So if you're sitting there with a bucket of 5 13-inch black drum, $150, $200, $100, $150. Let's call this $600-$800 in fines and court cost.
Yeah, minimum.
Yeah. So, understanding that you have two fish which are very, very similar looking. One has teeth, one has a beard. Don't keep the beatnik. Keep the one with the teeth. So, now, threading on and using, there's two schools of thought when it comes to hooks for these fish. The one is the big oversized hook. They put like a little fiddler crab or a sand flea on like a 4-aught J hook. Huge, huge hooks. Thinking they put it right by the point and they're going to get that fish. If they got to snag them, hook them, whatever, but that's their idea. And then you have the other school of thought, which is more of what I'm in line with, which is I'm going to go down to number 2 or number 4 hook. Now, if you're using a fiddler crab and you want to, excuse me, use a circle. See, I told you, neither one of us are doing well today. I don't know what's up with the whole GI thing, but, and we're not talking about government issue. The whole thing is if you're going to put a sheep head on a circle hook, you've got to be able to hook a fiddler crab. It's kind of built like a square. It's almost as wide as it is tall, and it's more of a rectangle-shaped creature with rounded ends. So I don't know what that would be described as. But you've got to figure out a way of getting that onto that circle hook, and that's double tough. But if you use a J-hook, what I do is go in between the legs because the shell is very hard. But if it was hard between their legs, they couldn't walk. So you got to have soft tissue by the legs just to allow them move their legs and be able to walk. So you go in next to the leg, stay as close as you can to the side. Don't put it in a big arc. You kill that bait. So you want to put it in right next to its legs, come straight up the side and out the top edge on the opposite side of the large claw if it's a male, either side if it's a female. Females have two small claws, male have one large claw. And the bigger the claw, the more female it gets.
Theoretically, yes. And it's just an ornamental claw at that.
And
you know,
the other fiddler crab's going around. It's all in how you use it, not how big it is. But yeah. I can eat just as many meals with my little claw.
Yes,
that's
absolutely
what they say. Fiddler crabs are weird.
Yes.
Okay. So anyway, with the fiddler crab, I go through the legs, stay as close to the side as you can, come out the top. If I have a small J hook, my favorite is the old gold forged Mustad. I think it's a 91670, 91663. It's the gold forged hook, beak hook, or whatever.
Right. Yeah, but I just looked at it earlier, too, and now I can't remember, but I think you're right, 91 or 92, 6.
I think it's a 663 or 673, but it's the gold one, not the silver one.
It's the thicker gauge one because there's two.
Yeah, you can't use the bent wire.
The thick one.
Yeah, the bent wire is a freshwater hook, mm-hmm. And what's nice about it, it'll straighten out. If you get a hook on it something, you can bend it back. But so will a decent sheephead pull it straight on you and you'll lose the fish. So it's got to be a forged hook.
Yeah.
But I use the gold, not the silver, not the black, not the other ones, because nobody fishes gold hooks anymore. Everybody has silver. They have black chrome. They have red. They got cadmium. But when's the last time, honestly, think about it, that you used a gold hook in saltwater?
Sheep's head fishing.
Yeah, it's literally the only time I still do it.
Yeah,
so
it's just it's a hook that's been being used for well over 50 years, and it works. It's proven itself. There's no frills about it. It works extremely well.
So to me, I'm just sitting there looking at this. It's not a hook fish readily see throughout the course of the year. It's not a color they see throughout the year. So it's a different color than anybody uses anymore. And it works great.
Yes.
But now I use that same hook if I'm going to fish frozen shrimp. Because I'm going to peel the tail just like I would if I was going to eat it. It would look like if you had one. What do they call that when they put the shrimp in a cup?
Cocktail.
Like a shrimp cocktail. So you peel all the shell off, leave the tail on just like you would if you were going to eat it. Put the start of the hook in. I'll use a number two a must-add hook for that. I put it right in at the tail, thread it into the meat so that just the point of the hook comes out of the meat. The eye of the hook is hidden in the tail. It's threaded all the way through and curved just like the hook, because that's the way a dead shrimp lays out in a J pattern.
Yeah, you're following the contour of its body.
Right.
So it flows right onto the hook naturally as all get-go.
And it's the natural appearance of the bait.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't see the hook because the eye is hidden in the flipper fan part of the tail, and the point is just barely sticking out, and it's more shrimp-colored, being gold. It's not silver or shiny. So, okay. And once they grab onto it, boom, you got them. And most of these fish...
Is that easy?
For me.
Okay.
Not for you. I didn't say that.
Definitely not.
That's
what
I was saying.
Go through three or four pieces of bait for every one of yours, probably.
But you want to go through and literally, the tricky part about the sheephead. Let's go into the sand fleas for just a second. When I'm putting a sand flea on, I use the same hook again. All these baits are about the same size. They all are effective, and that one hook seems to work on all of them. When I take a sand flea, it literally looks like a ginormous flea. So what I'm doing, I'm holding the sand flea and I turn it upside down so I can see where the legs are. Now, if I go out to the Gulf, I'm going to go about right where the water laps the beach, right at the edge of the sand. If you look out just a little bit, within a foot, you'll see about a 4-inch drop-off, 6-inch drop-off right there. Just a little tiniest bit of drop-down. I take my sand flea rake, go in there, scoop up along that edge, and then just dip it in the water to get all the sand out. It leaves a bunch of shells, and then you're going to see something that looks about like the end of your little finger down to the first joint. And it's a giant sand flea, or a sand flea. It looks like a giant flea. But when you turn it over, you get to see the little legs. Now, the feet are towards the tail. They move head first. So when they go to crawl along, they're crawling through the sand and darting through the water, but the feet are pointing towards the back. That's where I hook a sand flea. I go from the bottom, just about an eighth to 3/16 of an inch from the very back of the sheephead, from the bottom, or the sand flea, right out the top. I'm confused today. Did you notice that? I'm saying the wrong words, calling the wrong names.
You're just flip-flopping them. That's all right.
I just, I need some help.
Well, with the sand fleas, that you're buying them frozen because obviously, you already stated that they're very difficult to get live anymore. And even if you got them live, they're still so hard to hook without hitting any vital organs anyway. So it's just.
But that's why I go, through as far back as I can.
Mm-hmm.
And I come right through the bottom, I guess right where his butt would be.
Right.
And try and come out right through the shell in the back of it.
Right.
And that way, if he's alive, he's going to swim against the hook.
Right.
If he's frozen, he's going to lay there with the hook.
Yeah.
Either way. But that keeps me out. Like with the fiddler crab, I'm going through the leg trying to stay as close to the side. So when I point it through, I'm almost putting the hook straight up and down to go up till I hit the top shell and then turning it again to bring it back out. I'm not holding the hook at a side angle, putting it in, and then bending the whole thing to bring it back out the top. As soon as I get through that little bit of layer by the legs, I'm putting the hook straight up and down and lifting straight up so that I stay very close to the side. I don't hit his heart, his lungs, his gills, or anything else. I'm staying way over to the side of it. Keeps him alive better.
And I can see that, absolutely.
Now, with the frozen shrimp, I don't have as much problem keeping him alive. Now, if you get little jumper cables, and you, he will live, lives, lives.
You know? A little 9-volt battery and attached to him.
Yeah, yeah. Throw a 9-volt on him.
You know, and a trick that I like to do when using the frozen shrimp is I actually like to peel the shell off of them. And whether I'm standing on the pier or on a boat, I'll actually take that shrimp tail once I've shelled it, and I'll lay them on the deck or on the railing for a few minutes.
Oh, and you want them to get nice and stinky.
Well, I want them to get a little bit more dried out, a little bit more rubbery. They're just a little bit more sticky and tacky, and they stay on the hook just a little bit better. That gives me that maybe that half an extra shot at them.
That's a really good idea.
It helps. I mean, obviously, you know, you can take that piece of shell and also slide that on after you've put on the shrimp to help hold it on a little bit better. But me personally, I'm lazy. I just like to let it get rubbery and slide it on the hook that way.
Gotcha.
I heard of an old trick with a twist-em tie with shrimp.
Really?
Yep. You hook the shrimp the way Frank described it, and you push part of the shrimp up a little further past the eye of the hook, and you take a white twist-em tie, and so now you're actually twist-em tying the shrimp to the line and not to the hook. It's just up above it. And some guys clip the little edges off, but it's white, you know, so it kind of disappears in the shrimp. Makes it a whole lot harder to pull that shrimp off the hook. And they claim it gets the fish to be a little more frustrated and grab a little harder to get it to pull off.
That's cool.
Now, I have not done that, but I understand it's being done on the El Jobin Pier, and they seem to be doing pretty well.
Yeah, they're just now starting to perk up a little bit over there. It's still not in full swing. But they're definitely starting to see a few more fish there than they have been.
Well, that was kind of a neat trick. I haven't heard of that one before. That one's a new one on me.
Guy from Wisconsin told me that. He came down here and learned how to fish and got really frustrated. Okay. So he decided to tie his shrimp to the line and see. Let's see those son of a guns get it off this time.
Well, I can tell you, people from Wisconsin, notoriously cheap.
Yep. Twist 'em ties will do it. Don't be taking my shrimp.
I can honestly say, well, I may or may not have been raised there.
Right.
I'm gonna plead the fifth on that.
So now, how do you know how to set up your rig for fishing for those guys? Because I get so many guys telling me you have to do it this way, you have to do it that way. You need this sinker, you need that sinker, and I think it gets a little overwhelming to some of the people with that.
I'm going to say the number one way to do it is the way you catch sheephead with. The problem is rigs that work for one fella are not going to work for the other person. I know women who use a certain rig and catch a lot of sheephead, and somebody else tries it and they don't. If I'm going to do it, I'm going to think, where do the sheephead hang out? Now, they're not primarily bottom feeders. They don't really hang out right on the bottom much. No. Yes or no?
No, you're absolutely right.
I mean, they do go down and feed off the bottom. They absolutely do that. But they're not up by the surface a lot either.
No, their comfort zone is definitely suspended.
They like being around a piling, a reef or something, but not on the bottom, not by the top. So I'm going to say like 3-4 feet up off the bottom. If you're in, let's say you got 10 feet of water, they're going to want to be between 3 and 5 foot.
Yeah.
And a 10-foot... depth of water, 3 to 5 foot off the bottom.
Yeah, from the observations I've seen, I'd say that'd be pretty accurate.
All right, so if you know you got 10 feet of water and you want to be up there, probably the easiest thing to do is put a sinker on the end of a leader and then go up 6 or 7 foot and put a three-way swivel and tie your bait off at that point. And don't use a light sinker. Use an ounce, 2 ounces, whatever, heavy. You don't want the water to be able to drag it into the column. Here's the problem. The sheephead are usually looking into the current. So you've got to put your weight on the side of the piling that the water's trying to force it into the piling. So use a lot heavier sinker. I put it all the way at the bottom, and then I just go up and figure, where do I want my bait to be? And I tie my three-way on and put it right there, put my bait out off a three-way swivel. Now, whether that is 2 feet off the bottom, 3, 4, 7, you bring it up. All you've got to do is reel in enough to get to your leader. You grab that, bring the fish in, put your bait on it, swing it out, drop it back down. You don't have to bring that whole 6, 7 foot of sinker and line up onto the dock. You just need to get up as far as your leader. So you can be 7 feet with your three-way swivel with a leader off of it, which, believe it or not, cut yourself a good 2-foot piece of leader material, which I'm usually using like 15-pound fluorocarbon, maybe 20. But I'm going to tie one end to the three-way swivel. One end of the swivel goes to my line, the other end goes down to my sinker. But my leader material is going to be from that one of the three-way out to the hook. Now, just the act of tying a knot, you're going to end up with pretty much a foot. It's really hard to tie a knot in fishing line and not end up with about a foot spacing between it. So cut yourself an 18, 20, 24-inch piece of leader material so you actually have enough line to tie knots with. You want to tie one to the three-way, one to your hook. Now, if I've got a light current, I tie my hook close as I can to the swivel. If I've got a stronger current, I can put 2 feet easily away from my hook away from the swivel. A stronger current will lift that bait up and keep it up in the air. So a slower current, I'm relying on the thickness of my leader to kind of hold it out to the side a little bit.
Yeah. And me personally, I like to use only about 6 inches, maybe a foot of that leader, because I'm going to be holding it as close to that piling as possible with my sinker, hoping that current's going to lift it up and get it relatively close because they're moving up and down against those pilings.
Now, traditionally, these sinkers either come in brass color or black color. What about carrying a magic marker with you, change the color of their swivel?
Yeah, you could probably do that.
What if you took a magic marker, a white magic marker, and just made it white?
I'm not going to go through all that headache.
Or chartreuse.
I think it would probably work, but I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to stick with a plain old black swivel. That's just what I've always been comfortable with using, so I'm kind of a creature of habit.
Okay. You think changing the swivel color, change your luck?
I just don't think it matters.
Don't matter.
I don't think it matters. What's happening underwater is that bait is like a flag sticking out from the flagpole. And if you're 2-3 feet away from the swivel, I don't think it makes any difference. You know, the bait's coming out like a flag, and it's actually getting to the fish before the swivel does.
And Robert, he's doing it a very short leader, trying to fish very close to the piling, where if I've got the current, I want to hold my rod out a little bit and keep my swivel and my rig as far away from the piling and let the bait go to the piling.
Yeah.
There's two ways of doing it. Now, if the current's real slow, you've got to make your leader a lot shorter and put it right next to the piling. But at that point, I'm probably not going to use a three-way swivel. I'm going to tie a knot. I'm going to make a loop in it and then make a granny knot going through that loop 3 times to make a side loop off the side. And if I've got 15-pound test, if I can slide it through the loop of the eye of the hook, put the end of the leader doubled end through there and over the hook, just attach it that way. Or sometimes I have to tie a knot because the leader's too thick. I can't get it through the eye of the doubled. But there's a lot of different ways you can do it. You can just do a slip sinker rig and fish them on the bottom.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of guys will do the traditional, basically like a Carolina rig or a river rig. You know, is what I call it. Some people even call it a Florida rig, but essentially what it is your egg sinker goes on the top of your fishing line, then a barrel swivel, and then 18 to 24 inches of leader line, then with your hook tied directly to that, you can still fish that vertical, but it is usually a lot more productive by actually having that sinker sitting right on the bottom. And that way your bait is your line is actually sliding freely through that egg sinker and being pulled up by the current and moved around by the current, but you actually feel the fish at the same time as that fish feels you, because it doesn't have to lift up that sinker. Versus if you're fishing it straight up and down and holding it off the bottom, that fish has to grab that bait, move your leader, move the sinker, then you know he's
there. If you're holding it off the bottom, you should feel immediately if you're holding it up, the sinker up off the bottom.
But if that bait swings up a little bit off, you get that little bit of slack sometimes around those pilings with the current lifting up your leader a little bit, and he can kind of tug on it and pull before you know it.
No, I would say that would be pretty good. The only way I wouldn't do it is if you fix the sinker in one position.
Yeah.
If you tied your sinker onto the line,
okay,
then once it hits the bottom, they've got to drag that sinker around before you know that fish is there.
Yeah.
But even if it was tied and it was up in the water, I still think that would be good. You're very correct on the first one, but once it's up off the bottom, it should be just pulling line. It should be good.
Should be, but I mean, after me personally, because I'm a terrible sheep's head fisherman, you know, I tried it.
Let's take advice from the guy who can't do this.
Well, and that's what I'm getting at.
Okay.
Is that's the way I was taught, was the traditional Carolina rig. And I could catch a few, but the guys who got the knack for it were unbelievably good at it. And when I, because this time of year the water's very clear at most of the piers, and that's what I would do most of my sheep's head fishing, was on the pier. So I'm standing above them looking down and could see them at the time when they'd come up to the baits and stuff like that. And there were times where I'd physically see them take that bait but couldn't feel any nibbling or anything like that, and was relying on watching them take the bait and then trying to reel or set the hook on them. So that's when I started changing things up. And another guy who was extremely successful out there, the same as these other guys, was using the three-way swivel rig, and for some reason, I was able to feel that bite just a little bit better by having that sinker underneath rather than on top.
Okay.
And that was just me, you know.
All right. RJ, what's your rig?
I like the three-way swivel. And I liked your idea about tying a knot, because the sheep's head have very good vision. And when you got the water clear like that, you know, who knows? Does the swivel put them off or not? I don't know.
Well, that's why I was kind of thinking about it. If I had some colored magic markers, like a white and a yellow, or, you know, red or whatever, it could make a difference.
You bring cans of spray paint with you.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. It'd probably be easier to spray paint them.
Exactly right. Yeah, I don't know if it's all that important, but when you're dealing with a sneaky fish like that, probably everything you can do to your advantage, you should do.
Okay.
And I've always found it amazing how they get bait off a hook without you even knowing they got the bait off the hook.
It kills me.
Yeah. I mean, you're sitting there and you're wound up. You got the adrenaline going. You're holding the line between your pinky and your thumb, and you're waiting for the slightest bit of movement, and nothing happens for 20 minutes. And you say, you know, I think I need to check my bait. And you reel up and there's nothing there. How did they do that?
And there's a sharp point there.
Yeah,
even
with a barb.
When I'm tying a hook on, I'm getting poked and stuck. And I have fingers.
Yep.
You know?
And this fish has lips, but that's about it.
Yeah, he's taking it off with his teeth and his lips when I can't hardly put it on with my fingers without getting poked.
Without you feeling it, that's the kicker for me. Is I don't know how many times I've reeled up the empty hook and said, well, maybe it just fell off.
Yeah, what? Twisty ties.
Twisty ties.
That's right. What's going to do it.
I do definitely like that idea a lot.
You're going to hear a lot about red tide again right now. The red tide is in the area. A couple of weirder stories for you. Morris was working on a boat that he works on over there on the inside of Gasparilla Island. Bill and Linda went kayaking, fishing, less maybe an eighth of a mile away. I'm going to say a matter of 100 yards or a few hundred yards from where he was, but let's say an eighth of a mile away.
Right.
And Morris was wearing a mask. The fish in the canal were dying. He couldn't hardly breathe. And yet, less than an eighth of a mile away, they went kayaking and never noticed anything about the red tide.
Nothing at all. And Bill is extremely sensitive to red tide because he's got some asthma conditions, I believe. And usually people with any type of asthma condition or smokers who have done damage to their lungs have a more extreme sensitivity to it than others. And he said if it's in the area, he's going to know it first. They saw a couple of dead fish. Most of them were older dead fish, a couple of fresher fish, but never had any effects of it and were catching. He caught a 32-34 inch redfish out of that area, along with a couple small snook and a couple smaller redfish. He broke his rod actually on that big redfish because he went to net it, and as soon as he netted it, it jumped out of the net and popped his rod.
So, hopefully it was a star or a pen and we can replace it.
Yeah, he's taken care of. But it was just one of those funny moments and funny stories because it's like everything that's leading up to them getting there and they're thinking, oh no, this is not going to be good. We see some of these dead fish. Well, I'm not feeling any of it. Let's go give it a try and go fishing. They catch fish. He catches one of his biggest redfish ever and still has an incredible fishing experience. And yet, like you said, eighth of a mile away tops.
And the weird part about it was, this happened on the same day, guys.
Yeah.
This is not one day to the next day. This was the same day. One guy working on his boat and was trying to get stuff done who couldn't even finish working on the boat, even though he had a mask on. He's, again, very susceptible to red tide, just like Bill. But Bill was less than an eighth of a mile away and didn't even know it was there. Now, up by Placida, we had a guy. He had pinfish traps out.
Correct. Him and his son were going to plan an offshore trip the next day, so they usually set up some pinfish traps out the night before, and then on their way out, they stop and pick up their pinfish traps, so they have nice, fresh bait first thing in the morning, ready to go, and there are three pinfish traps in about 4 feet of water, had about 60 or 70 pinfish total in all three of them. They took them out, put him in the live well right there. He said within 2 minutes they were all dead. Never felt the red tide. All the pinfish were alive in 3.5-4 feet of water inside those traps. The moment he pulled them out and put them in his live well, they were done.
All right, to explain this, is the fish were down 3-4 feet under the water. Red tide likes to float, and when red tide is there, that first 6 to 10 inches of water is where you're going to find the red tide under normal circumstances, unless you get a bit of wind agitation, and then the waves will mix it up and send it down further. But on a relatively calm day, that red tide stays at the surface. The water pickup that fed water into his live well was about 6 inches underwater, and that was pulling red tide water up into their live well, and those fish couldn't handle it. So when they were down 3-4 feet, they were perfectly fine. The red tide wasn't bothering them a bit. But as soon as they had to be in that water, that was at first 6 inches of the water column, they died.
Yep.
Now, RJ, you look like you had something to say there.
Well, I was just thinking that we're probably going to see these spotty, high concentrations of red tide over the next couple of months. We still have the problem in Venice with the sewage coming out of the treatment plant. And then I just read the other day that there's another leak at the Mosaic holding pond. It's a couple thousand acres of water, and that's leaking now into Tampa Bay. So that stuff comes our way, right? Comes down from Tampa.
Yeah, anything that happens up in Tampa ends up here.
Yeah, so phosphates are moving in our direction, and that's kind of where you get this stuff. We've been lucky that we've had a lot of wind pushing everything offshore for a while.
Well, hopefully our wintertime pattern holds a little more true and we start getting a lot more northeast winds. That will help a lot. But if you start hearing winds, anything with west in it, red tides are going to get bad. Anything with east in it, it's going to blow it out towards the Gulf. So that's literally that.
And the cooler weather is definitely going to help. That cooler water temperature, because it is a plant by nature. You know, it's a plant animal. It's not a full-blown whatever. It's a weird thing, but it's still a plant. And just like your grass in your front yard, you get the dry season, no rain, grass stops growing. Cooler weather, naturally going to slow things down from growing. So it does start to stun it a little bit. It doesn't kill it off by any stretch, but it will slow down that whole process of blooming faster or at an alarming rate. It takes a lot of push and shove and momentum to really get it going again.
And I think
that's a good thing.
And red tide is something that we just have to live with. And it's gotten worse, yes, and there's going to be some
time. Actually, that's not true.
It's not true. It hasn't gotten worse.
No, it has not gotten even a little bit worse.
All right, so I stand corrected. But it's my point being, it's still something we have to live with. And it doesn't
what
blanket
did get
everything.
Better was picture sharing on Facebook.
Oh, yes, yes. I'll go along with
red
that.
Red tides have gotten no better or no worse. But the ability to share pictures with a lot of people has amplified immensely. You can take a picture of something in 1982 of a catastrophic red tide event, and maybe a few people are going to see it. 2 years ago or a year ago, you took one picture of the red tide, posted it on Facebook, it went to Twitter, Instagram, it hashtagged red tide. 4 million people saw that picture.
Right, right.
The picture sharing got better. The red tide is not better or worse. But we have some very high concentrations in Lee, Charlotte, Collier, Sarasota, all these counties. Every county around here has got pretty good concentrations of red tide. Even though the truth of the matter is, we have red tide, I would say, at least 4 months out of the year. Probably the truth is closer to 8 to 9 months out of the year that we have some levels of red tide. But it's just when it gets bad, and then it goes away.
Yeah, it's just it's a normal thing. You know, you get your super blooms, just like certain years you get real heavy pollen count from the oak trees and the pine trees. Anyone who's lived here for a couple years knows that in the springtime you walk out to your car in the driveway, and it's completely covered in this yellow dust. You go out there the next year, same time frame, very minimal yellow dust, and it's you can kind of use that as a idea of how red tide works in that aspect, that every now and then it just gets tough.
It just
a
gets
tough
bad.
Year, and then
now,
other times it's nothing.
With the water temperature, if you are north of us, the Gulf temperatures are all 3 to 5 degrees below normal. As you go south of Boca Grande Pass, the water becomes, let's say, or is it 4 degrees above normal. So it's warmer than average water down by the Keys. It's colder than average water from St. Pete up. So the Gulf is colder than it should be north of us, warmer than it should be south of us. We're about on the average. We're going to be about 70, 71, 72 degrees. We're about what we should be. We're in that normal range for Gulf water temperatures, around 70. Now, the harbor, when you have the shallows and the surface waters of the harbor, you're going to see them fluctuate 5, 6, 8 degrees during the course of a day. But what's really weird is the water underneath doesn't change as much. But now in Tampa, their water changes as the Gulf temperatures change in Tampa Bay, because you have a big, wide open mouth of Tampa Bay. So you have a huge amount of water going in and a huge amount of water coming out. And I don't remember what the tide difference there is, but I think it's like 3 or 4 feet.
I think it's only about 3 feet.
I think it's about between 3 and 4 feet per 24-hour period. 10,000 Islands is 4 feet. We're at about 2 feet a day.
Okay.
So I think they're a little higher than us.
Yeah, they are higher than us. So
I'm going to say,
but even a foot difference is still an astronomical amount of water leaving and coming.
What makes Charlotte Harbor so unique from Tampa Bay, the Keys, 10,000 Islands, any of these places, is our water comes in and out through these little tiny passes. So we only exchange about 2 feet of water up and down during the course of the day, from 0 to 2 and from 2 to 0 in whatever combination it comes in. It might be from 1 to 1.5 to 1.4 to 1.8 down again, but we exchange about 2 feet of water a day. But it's a very slow moving tides compared to Tampa, compared to the Keys. So there they have much more water rushing in and much more water rushing out, where ours is much slower. So those bottom temperatures don't change as much.
Right. Well, it's...
And they can be, the flats are warmed up by the sun. With that slow-moving water on the flats, you get a little bit of brown, a little bit of black. You can raise that flats temperature 5-6 degrees in a day.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what some people are seeing right now with that 64, you know, first thing in the morning, and then 70, 71 degrees by the late afternoon.
Yeah. So what we're saying is, there's a lot of differences with water play fish, everything else. The good news is fishing is actually pretty good right now. And we're going to wish you guys happy Thanksgiving, because I don't think we're here next week.
Right? Yeah, we're going to take next week off.
So
We'll play some encore show.
Well, I've got a God in Fishing you can play. It's a 55-minute show. Try that one. Listen to some really strange guys having a lot of fun next week at this time slot. So,
and we'll see you again in 2 weeks.
We'll see you. Happy Thanksgiving from RJ, our good friend and producer, Robert, my best buddy, and me. I'm Fishing Frank. So bye, guys. Happy Thanksgiving. Sinker and line.